Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Amor Towles, author of The Rules of Civility, which has been selling in hardback and paperback in my bookstore for seemingly the last decade or so now. Now with his new novel, A Gentleman in Moscow, I'm afraid he will be taking up too much space in our crowded shop. Suffice it to say that The Rules of Civility was a lovely book, which remains one of our bestsellers, in large part because I and all my staff tell everyone to read it, and I've sent it to at least 10 friends. The new book, set in another land and another time, is of equal or greater quality, and it introduces us to another side of an author whose books will one day, after we're both gone, probably be in our classics section. A Gentleman in Moscow explores a world in which a life is lived with pleasure, curiosity, and purpose, although that life is constrained spatially and by imprisonment. Characters and the reader are drawn to the protagonist, the Count, through his charm, his kindness, his knowledge, and he gives, as we all should, as he receives. So the book is suffused with love and possibility. It helps the reader to remember that what's worthwhile in life is not measured in travels or houses or jewels, but in our relationship with those that we love and the corollary relations with those who may not be ladies or gentlemen. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, welcome, Amor, and thanks for joining us again on The Avid Reader.
Thank you, Sam.
So before
Sam, I don't think I should answer a single question after that lovely introduction. I think I should
okay,
say thank you for having me and hang up before I screw it up.
All right, see ya.
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, okay, so before my usual dissection, which you may remember from the last interview, why don't you go ahead while you have a chance and tell us a little bit about the book?
Sure. I mean, because the book does have a bit of an odd premise, in that it opens at a Bolshevik tribunal in the Kremlin in 1922, where a 30-year-old aristocrat is being interviewed. And in the course of this brief interview, it becomes clear that the Count, who wrote a poem that was popular with the revolutionary generation as a younger man, he has friends high up in the party, a few friends, as it were, but he's also clearly an unrepentant aristocrat. And the tribunal views him as, in essence, a danger to the new society they're trying to develop. So they kind of almost to strike a compromise, they tell him that he can go back to the metropole where he's been staying, and if he ever comes out of the hotel again, he will be shot. The book then opens with him being marched out of the Kremlin across Red Square and through the doors of the historic Metropole Hotel, where he spends the next 32 years, and where I ask you, the reader, to spend those years as well.
It's so funny in the beginning when you have the transcript of the indictment, the trial, and the verdict, and when he presents himself as master of the hunt, and and everyone laughs in the courtroom, and the tribunal is, you know, appalled, but at the same time, you know, kind of not appalled. That's only like 3 or 4 pages, and it's in a different font, but it's really funny.
Thank you.
And then also, the book, there's a couple of structural aspects to the book. First of all, why don't you explain the pyramidical, that's a word, nature of the way you built the book and then came downhill as well.
Sure. An aspect of the novel, which I hope those who read the book wouldn't even notice this until, you know, it was pointed out to them after the fact, but the novel has a relatively specific structure in that it tells what happens to the Count the day after he is put under house arrest in the hotel, 2 days later, 5 days later, 10 days later, 3 weeks later, 6 weeks later, 3 months later, 6 months later, a year later to the day, then 2 years later, 4 years later, 8 years later, 16 years later, sort of in this doubling principle. And when it kind of hits the midpoint of the story in 1938, having started in 1922, it moves in reverse direction. So you go from that midpoint to 8 years later, and then 4 years beyond that, and 2 years beyond that, and 1 year, and working your way down to 6 months until the end of the book, 3 months, 6 weeks, 3 weeks, 10 days, 5 days, 2 days, 1 day, to the very exciting conclusion of the book. But so there, it is kind of like an accordion structure, And I think it is. I mean, it's, as I say, I hope no reader is like is noticing that even as they read. Hope that's a it's a helpful tool for me as an artist, much in the way that you know a sonnet of 14 lines and 10 you know beats per line is a structure that can serve the poet in refining a work of art. This structure does the same for me, but I think it's very true to the way that we often can experience time, and that it's very granular kind of at the beginning of this experience, but as the years go on, the count and we sort of experience his life in the hotel in kind of leaps, you know, where you kind of go through a phase where he takes on a job, and you kind of suddenly, you know, 4 years go by or 8 years go by, and which I think is the way it happens in life. You know, when we're 25 in a new city, we remember every little detail of that time, but then suddenly, you know, you have the first 8 years of your career, and it kind of has a lump, and then you get married, and you have children, and 10 years go by, and you know, it's the you know the years of raising your kids, and so time can be experienced in both of these different ways, and the book, you know, manages its large scope, a story of 32 years, through this structure.
It's funny because it was kind of bittersweet to me as a reader, and at the same time as a bookshop owner, and I guess a literary critic, it's also fascinating how you engage the reader. For example, this whole 32-year period, I'm going to myself like I used to when I was a kid. Wow, 32 years, I'd read a news story, brothers reunited after 15 years, and I go, oh my God, 15 years.
Right.
And then now I'm thinking back 32 years in my life. I'm 64, and I'm thinking, well, I can remember all that stuff.
You're right.
It doesn't seem like that long ago.
No, right.
And so when you're reading the book, you go, oh, that's amazing. How could he be there for 32 years? It's impossible. And then you realize, wait a minute, I've been here 32 years.
Right.
So it does catch you up in that. And then the other structural thing is the book has an enormous amount of assonance because everything begins with A. How did that happen?
Yeah, the chapters, again, this is an odd element. Again, almost, I like to think that, you know, readers, it might take them a while to even notice this, you know, a reader who doesn't hear this, but is all the chapters titles begin with the letter A, and, you know, or phrases with A words, and, you know, that, you know, why, it's kind of an instinctive thing in a way, I guess, I mean, because I don't have the most profound reason. I think my instinct to do that was partly to ensure that the reader knew there was sort of a bit of play involved in the story. There is, even the premise itself is fantastic to some degree. There are fantastical elements to the tale. This is not a history of Russia during the Stalinist period, nor is it an acute investigation of the worst aspects of that era. And so I want the reader to know that, you know, what we're stepping into is a narrative that Russia is a setting for the story. You know, what happened in Russia is meaningful to the story, and yet it is a story. It's an invention. We're going to follow the characters, follow the central character and his friends, and try to explore life through that, much in the way, you know, that we would in any novel. We don't go back and read, Henry James to get an acute sense of a particular, you know, time period or a particular, you know, life in London or Italy, you know, or New York in a particular year. We read it for the relationship of the characters and for the language that can give us insights, ideally pleasure and insights, ideally into the human condition. And I'm certainly not saying I'm as good as James, but it's the same ambition. So yeah, as I say, the titles there are kind of a way of signaling, yeah, this is a work of art you're about to read, you know, and inviting the reader to read it in that spirit.
Yeah, there's a lot of things, and I was surprised in one of your interviews, you know, obviously as an author, these things do come to you, but then when you realize that the sous chef, all of a sudden you realize he's a juggler. I mean,
yeah.
It's, again, for the reader, it's like, you're writing and all of a sudden it comes into your mind, oh, well, you know what? I didn't realize he was a juggler. Is that how it happened?
Yeah, Sam. I mean, it's exactly right. Because I am, you know, I think as you recall, I am an outliner. You know, not all authors are. I outline my rules of civility. I outlined it in great detail before, you know, writing the first chapter. I did the same thing with a gentleman in Moscow. So I have sketched out, or I mean, beyond sketch, I've detailed what's going to happen, where the chapters take place, who is in the room, what they are like, what some of the conversations are, what some of the imagery is all before I start. But yet, as you get into the story, there are surprises, and a lot of surprises can be driven by, you know, the characters kind of catch you off guard. And yes, there is kind of a scene where three, at this point, the Count and two people he's become friends with in the hotel over many years, they work together. They're kind of talking about their backgrounds, and you know, I had not have that in my notes, you know, what they all did. So suddenly, you know, it's got to be there. And the, you know, I think maybe I knew that the maitre d' in the restaurant had run away with the circus at some point, and that's how he ended up in Russia. But I didn't know what he did. And of course they ask, and you know, and suddenly it's like, oh my God, he juggles knives. So yeah, it is, you know, as the two characters are surprised, you know, sort of pleasantly by this, and seeing him do it, I was kind of went through that same experience, which adds a little flair to the scene, actually, I think, because it caught me off guard.
It does. And then also, again, let me tell you, from as a reader, I'm really worried because Emil gives him his knife, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, he's definitely going to cut his hand off. Oh. You know, it's like I'm thinking, okay, just use three knives. Do not use that knife. Do not juggle with that knife. Isn't that funny how you feel that way?
Right.
It's like, and the other funny, there's so much funny stuff in this book. It's like when Emil is going after the bishop, and he's brandishing his knife at him, but it's really a stalk of celery.
Yeah, right.
And then, oh, and the other really, really funny one was when the Count, who thinks he's this big shot and doesn't feel like, I guess it was Sophia, didn't know what, had never seen an elephant or whatever.
Yeah. Right.
And she says, which have I not seen, the elephant or the lamp?
Yeah, right. I mean, I think, you know, the Count is kind of as a character, he is, you know, he's raised in he comes out of 19th century nobility as an individual, and he's raised in the refinements of the 19th century, whether that's the novels or the classical music, the fine food, fine wine. Those are his strong suits, and as you kind of meet him, he kind of seems omnipotent, and, you know, all powerful through these, you know, through these sort of delicate things that he's mastered, but. As you kind of go through the story, it becomes clear that, you know, he has many things he has not mastered. And yes, one of the places, you know, he starts to encounter two younger women in particular, two girls at different stages in his life, and they constantly pull the rug out from under him. I enjoy that. I mean, kind of that, we get vested in the character and assume he's sort of perfect, and then, you know, like he constantly is misjudging or being, you know, caught off guard, or as I say, having the rug pulled out from under him by his friends and companions. And that's, you know, I think that's sort of human nature.
Well, like giving you feedback again, whether you want it or not,
yep.
It's like, again, being 64, I tend to tell tales more than once. And when he says,
yeah,
I'm going to tell you a story that you've never heard before about the Blue Ribbon. And she goes, oh, I think I might have heard this. And then he goes on. And the same thing happens to me so often.
Yeah,
I realize, you know, I think I've told this before, and
yeah, that's a little bit. It's funny. I mean, I'm 51, but that scene is a tribute to my father. You know, who was the same kind of thing. We'd all be like, "Yes, we know the story," and he, just like the Count, would be like, "No, it's impossible. I could never have told you this."
But when
we definitely know it.
And the thing is, that's really good about that is when you love someone a real lot, you let them tell the story again and again and again, and pretend like it's the first time.
Right.
What was I going to ask you about? Oh, I was going to ask you about Herr Drosselmeyer or Field Marshal Kutuzov.
Yeah.
I don't know. Okay, tell us about him.
Yeah. So there, again, part of the slightly fantastic aspect of the book is the hotel of the cat, sort of the house cat, who's a one-eyed cat, and the Count, part of. He constantly shows off his erudition a little bit, and somewhat playfully, and he befriends the one-eyed cat in his under house arrest, and every time he sees the cat, he will refer to the cat by, you know, in essence, a famous person with an eye patch, you know. So, you know, Herr Drosselmeyer is the one-eyed, the eye-patched godfather in the Nutcracker, and Kutuzov was the eye-patched general that led the troops, the Russian troops against Napoleon, and obviously is therefore a figure in War and Peace. Lord Nelson, you know, comes up later in the book again as an eye-patched member of figure from history who has bearing on sort of something that the Count does. So, So yeah, it's kind of a, you know, sort of a playful thread that runs through the story, through this cat, is sort of these eye-patched figures from history who poke their heads out from scene to scene.
It's funny too, because, you know, even knowing that it's 32 years and the field marshal no longer is with us, there's still something almost, you make it almost like spirit-like, that he's almost kind of still there. You know, and that was fascinating too. I really like that.
And again, a little bit of a fantastic element, I suppose. But I think, you know, one way or another, somewhat true to life, right? As we get older, you, me, whether literally or figuratively, ghosts from our past do sort of resurface. You know, we go back to a place we haven't been in a while, and you know, we can kind of feel the old voices or the old relationships that were there, and so you get some. You imagine that if you've lived in a building for 30 years, but people have come and gone. You know, generations have come and gone. That, you know, you and you've been there. There would be many ghosts in the buildings for you.
Well, like the barber, you know, the original barber, and then it's kind of the same barber, but it's not at all. Especially since they're being replaced by the proletariat.
But
and there's magic lotion and the one-line notes. I end up telling you things that nobody else knows because they haven't read it yet, but they were so fascinating to me. One thing, and if you think this is a spoiler, don't tell it, but people measure the world and history, and even like in this election cycle, such a strange way of measuring things. But the count measures changes in the world and in a sliding doors kind of way. He measures it by climate, by temperature.
Again, it's sort of the count is, you know, is a little bit of a whimsical figure. So he's been raised. He's not as profound as his education might have hoped him to be, you know, or not as rigorous. So, although, you know, he kind of was raised to study the figures of the Enlightenment and the, you know, the classics and, you know, the Stoics, et cetera, and he has a certain amount of admiration for them. For him, you know, he talks about philosophy in terms of temperature and kind of pointing out how moderate changes in the temperature of things can have big outcomes in the way that things occur in life, you know, whether it's the temperature of, you know, if the meat is undercooked or overcooked, whether the wine is, you know, is perfectly chilled or not chilled, and, you know, these, or how cold it is outside, that if you kind of go through a single day, you know, those slight changes in temperature can result in big changes in outcomes in our lives. And in a way, it's sort of a whimsical tribute to, you know, a central thesis of War and Peace, you know, in terms of the way in which, you know, history is affected by these small actions of individuals. You know, the Count has his own whimsical version of that thought process.
Yeah, that chapter, that section was really nice about the party and that's friend slipping and all that. That was really well done. Speaking of wine, why don't you tell the story about what the Russians did with the wine cellar and talk a little bit about how extensive it was and how the Count responded.
Well, first of all, I should say that, you know, part of the pleasure of writing for me about a period, you know, 70 years ago, roughly, is that most of us have some familiarity with whether New York was like or Europe was like 70 years ago, but almost none of us have firsthand experience with what the world was like there in any adult sense. And so I like to, you know, use the rough familiarity people have to build a landscape that is believable and then take liberties there, inventing incidents that where it's not clear to the reader anymore. Wait, is this a, you know, historical event, or is this a made-up event? And you know, one of my favorites is that at a certain point, somebody, the Count is, you know, spends time in the fine restaurant in the hotel, and which has a very famous wine cellar. And someone in the years shortly after the revolution, when the Count is interned, has pointed out that having bottles of wine in a, you know, expensive wine list is kind of anti-proletarian. That it, you know, it's effete, it's privileged, it's backward, and you know, it encourages speculation, etc. And so the order comes down to remove the wine labels from all the bottles in this famous wine cellar. And I've had people say, did that really happen? You know, it did not happen to the best of my knowledge, but. For me, it's symbolic of, I wanted an event for the Count at that point in the book, which is still pretty early in the book, to confront the fact that, you know, that his world is not coming back. You know, the the Bolsheviks were going to be relatively ruthless in ensuring that his way of life was uprooted and you know, erased. And so he's kind of fending off his acceptance of that, even under house arrest in the early years. But slowly it's becoming clear to him. And this scene, yes, in the wine cellar, looking at all these bottles without their labels, is kind of the final moment where he's like, you know, yeah, this, it, we are, this is, we, you know, it's like the label has been removed from him, in essence.
Yeah, and he's such an onophile, and when he recommends to that couple the wine, it's just such a tragedy. And again, what you do to me in these books is like, okay, you say it took 10 men 10 days to do that, so then I had to get a pencil
right,
and figure out they had to take the labels off 1,000 bottles of wine a day, each of them had to take 1,000 labels off each day. So it's funny because you drilled it, you make the, which is great about books, is that you don't make us, but you pull us into drilling down through your book. And I always think that's one of the best things that you can do.
Yeah, well, thank you. I agree with you that I think it's what we value in the best of books, and it's what, you know, as an artist I aspire for too, is to create a level of detail that the reader can both see and be surprised by and intrigued by, and as you say, it's an invitation to sort of investigate a little bit further, you know, into the scene or the situation or the way something has been put.
Yeah, and I really don't mean it as a compliment, although I know it sounds like that, but what it means to me is that it compliments me to a certain extent, actually. It's the fact that I have the ability, the desire, the inquisitiveness, the curiosity to say, okay, this is happening now. I wonder what's really happening. I wonder what's happening behind this. And you're the person who kind of layers it, but I'm the person who discovers the layers, and I give myself, both of us, plaudits for that. And
Yep, I think you're absolutely right, and I often think of, you know, if somebody says, you know, does your book, you know, have a central theme or whatever, you know, my response is I hope not, you know, I mean, is that what you hope is that the book has many themes and has a richness of texture and human interaction and imagery that would allow a variety of investigations and conclusions. And and you're right, that ends up being the reader's job, you know, or the opportunity. I have to create an environment that is rich enough and intriguing enough that the reader wants to, you know, dwell in space and consider it. But you're right, I don't want to tell them what to think about it by any means.
It's funny because there are so many characters in this book, and I kind of want to talk about each of them, but I can't, and I don't think the readers would like that. But even if you just take the handyman, for example, who only figures into what, maybe 2 pages tops, but you've drawn him in such a way that he really does convey to you his inherent goodness. Well, you definitely do, and he brings back to the Count a memory that the Count would never have had but for that.
Right.
And that also, that does have the element of the fantastic too, doesn't it?
Yeah, particularly with the bees.
Yeah, with the apples and the bees, and then Anna Urbanova. She's another meticulously drawn character, and who figures, especially in one specific section, you know, in which she's willowy. And I love the way that the Count discovers the constellations on her back. Talk a little bit about that, and maybe a little bit about their love affair.
The Count does meet a sort of an actress. He meets an actress. In the early years that he's there, when she's kind of at the top of her fame, and they kind of have a contentious sort of relationship initially, and it's a little romantic, but it's also a little combative. And she disappears, and in this kind of leaping way through the book, you kind of go from 1 year to several years later, and she's back at the hotel, but she's undergone, like many Russians did, you know, she's gone from fall from grace, and she's slowly working her way back up, and this has a big, profound impact on their relationship, because you know, as it's put in the book, you know, they become members of the Confederacy of the Humble. They have been through both a humbling experience, and you have to decide when you're humbled, how do you respond to that? You know, do you hide? Do you fake it? You know, or do you sort of accept it and try to find kind of a almost like a Zen-like wisdom out of having been humbled? And and that's their instinct, the two of them, and that kind of allows them to forge a bond, even as she is, renewing her fame. She kind of will never leave that the Confederacy of the Humbled, and they will have a connection forever as a result.
And their relationship really bookends the, no pun intended, the book, because she's kind of like his doppelganger. She's always beautiful. She always returns, and she's very resilient and never gives up, ever.
That's right.
And then that ties in nicely with the novel itself. Tell the story about how she throws the blouse out, her clothes out the window, and how it relates to your parents.
In the story, when they first meet the count, and she kind of, because she's annoyed with him, feels he's put on airs, she's proud and famous and is offended by this. She sort of seduces him and kicks him out of the bedroom to teach him a lesson. And as he's leaving, he sees her blouse on the floor and picks it up and hangs it up, and this annoys her in retrospect. And so, kind of to teach the count a lesson retrospectively, she starts leaving her clothes on her floor, of her apartment, every night. And she instructs her staff to, leave it there and not pick it up. And eventually her maid sort of complains, and the actress, sort of in a fit of pique, gathers up the clothes and throws it out the window to teach her maid a lesson. And the maid kind of coolly goes off to bed and, is not impressed with the act. And the actress goes to sleep goes to bed in sort of fury, and several hours later tiptoes outside and goes and gathers all the clothes back up, and kind of gets to go through this whole cycle of pride and being put in her place and sort of coming around to realizing she's overdone it, and all kind of in this one sort of detail. And yes, it is one of those fun things about writing a book. That is something, a version of that happened between my mother and father when they were first married. There were clothes on the floor, and one of my parents did throw the clothes out the window, and the parent went to bed as if nothing happened, and then the first parent got up in the middle of the night and went and gathered the clothes back up from the courtyard. And I will leave it to you to figure out whether it was my mother or father who did which. But yeah, it is family lore.
It's obvious that you love Russian literature, and in that presentation book that's given to the Count of Bread and Salt, there's this listing of Russian authors and wonderful quotes in which the term bread is used. But I wondered, I feel the same way, and my brother and I, when we used to read Gogol, particularly The Overcoat and The Nose,
yeah,
we would just laugh uproariously. The Overcoat, getting out of a the Nose getting out of the carriage as a functionary, as he rises up above the level of the person whose nose is. Does that make you, we would laugh so hard we would get sick, but I don't know whether you responded that way to that.
Oh, I think it's very. I love Gogol. He's very funny, and the way of the best of humor is often insightful or cutting or unsettling. I love Louis C.K. It's comedy, and it has those elements. It can be both outrageous or absurdist, but at the same time, it's very insightful about our lives, or about America, or whatever he's focused on, and it can be unnerving, and at the same time, and Gogol certainly has a gift for that in narrative, he is certainly a sort of one of those shadows in the back of the novel, in steering it in certain ways.
Yeah, I think so. It's what's really sad about this election cycle is we've gone past that point where you can do that story, because it's already being done in real life,
Yeah, right.
It sucks.
Right.
So, talk about one of the best chapters is the bouillabaisse and the ingredients that were necessary and how that was done. That was very, very interesting.
Yeah, the elements become at various times and Soviet history, luxuries were hard to come by. Basics could be hard to come by, at certain times for certain people. And so there is kind of this notion that the count and two of his two closest friends kind of within the hotel, who are all lovers of food, reminisce about having we kind of before we don't see this, but they have reminisced at some point about how great it is to eat bouillabaisse in France and the south of France and what a rich experience that is. And they form a little conspiracy, which is, you know, they at all costs they want to recreate bouillabaisse, which has this elaborate group of ingredients, some of which are very hard to come by, and so they kind of connive and conspire and collude to gather those elements together, and it takes them more, you get the sense, years or whatever, but eventually they all the pieces are there at the same time and they're ready to go, and it comes to sort of, you build a celebration late at night for the three characters around having this victory of assembling this dish with the hard to come by elements.
Which is actually a good time to bring up the subject of, most of the characters in the book are good people. There's one particularly who enters vaguely in that scene is the bishop.
Yeah.
And he doesn't really have a name, and the funny thing about him, and it's very subtle, is the way he travels. He travels in these diagonals.
Yeah.
But how did you think of him, and how did you think to create this metaphor, analogy, whatever it is, that's the way he moved? Because it is the way a lot of people move in life.
Yeah, that was early. It came right off the bat. I have no idea. But yes, he was, as a character, he was named the bishop in my mind from the very first.
That's interesting.
That's kind of he's the nemesis, in essence, of the main character. And looks like the bishop on a chessboard, and so the count kind of recognizes that he kind of moves and acts like a bishop on a chessboard, being a little bit, superior and, being a little oblique in his movements and what he has to say, he is the opponent, as it were, for the count in the story.
But he really is he the only bad guy? I mean, even
he's one of them. Yeah, it is a, and maybe this is to a fault. I mean, the novel is generous towards people because the count is generous. The count, and as someone accuses him of in the book, he tends to see the best in people. Wants to see the best in people, and so that's what you get to see through his eyes. And there are everybody has their failings. Nina has her failings, and Emil has his failings, but the count, we see their failings through his eyes, which even the failings are seen generously, meaning they're kind of seen as quirks of character, idiosyncrasies, where a more cynical person would find it just of a deep flaw in the other individual. The count kind of sees past that and finds the charm in the individual, even when they are difficult in some way. But certainly the count's best friend Mishka has his problems. Osip, the government agent, has his problems. Everybody ideally is three-dimensional.
Yeah, but he's good.
Yeah, well, he is and he isn't, right? I mean, that's,
yeah,
says, he's obviously been a part of making decisions which were not attractive. I mean, presumably he's overseen imprisonments and punishments and, a variety of unseemly things. But that's outside the periphery of the count's engagement with him. And so, yes, he forms his own relationship with him, and it is a generous one.
I've forgotten the name of the, I don't know how I forgot it, the name of the gentleman that he watches the movies with and he's teaching language.
Osip, yeah.
Yeah. So he's another one that has, at first you think, a certain way, and then there's a moment where you realize the exact opposite. Well, he's mixed, right? It's
yeah.
Same thing.
As I say, the book is not a history of Russia by any means. It's a novel, but it draws on some realities of Russian life, in those decades, and a major reality of life in those decades was that those who were in the leadership of the party only was 10% of the population, those who were members of the party and who were in the leadership in particular had significant privileges, access to stores, they had access to apartments that people could have, access to better education, a little bit more favorable treatment by the judicial system unless they were in out of favor, and So they had real privileges, and so patronage was a very important part of Soviet life. If you could, befriend one of these members of the party who had clout, and they became your patron, whatever, you didn't even have to be an artist. You could just be a person, a beautiful girl, or whatever. But or a nice person, but or you could be an artist, an author, a performer. a patron was a hugely valuable resource in the Soviet era. They could, through their privilege, you know, allocate some of that to you. If you were in trouble, they could fend off the authorities potentially. And we see this throughout actual Russian history of following, you know, the major literary figures of that time. You know, those who survived often had a patron, and if they ran afoul of the patron, it was in danger, you know, et cetera. They got their dacha through the patron. So there are a couple of cases where patronage plays an important part in this novel. Anna has her patron, and he kind of grows importance off stage. We never meet him, but it's clear that she can get certain things done because of her relationship to the senior member of the party. And Osip, in a way, becomes a patron to the count to some degree. He's obviously an influential person who befriends the count, and that's an advantage to the count at a critical moment.
That's funny. I just interviewed this guy who wrote this book, The Senility of Vladimir P., and it posits that Putin has been elected president 5 times, prime minister twice, and now he's 80 years old and he's senile. And it's, you know, definitely like magical realism. But it's funny because when someone would come in for a favor and wearing some expensive Philippe Patek watch or something like that, Putin would just look at the guy's wrists and he would just take the watch off and hand it to him. And that was in order to get what you wanted, that's what you'd have to do.
Right, right.
And if he looked at the watch and the other guy offers it and he said no, Putin didn't want it because it wasn't good enough, just a Rolex Oyster Perpetual or something, then the guy knew that next day he would have to give him something better than his watch.
Right, right.
But it's funny, I was talking, this is what happens when I schedule an interview way in advance. So we got the galley in, and I'm looking for it to read it, and it's gone because every one of my staff members moved it, read it, and moved it to the next staff member before I could get to it. So everyone in the bookstore is familiar with it and can talk about it. And I was talking to Judy today in the store, and we were talking about how the characters almost seem like Jungian archetypes in a way, and specifically with Nina and Sophia, because, you know, the count's saying in a specific time that things will happen that will come to her, and she will then basically life will manifest itself to her, and
yep.
Whether it happens or not, I'm not going to say. But then with Sophia, who's almost again like a doppelganger, and but more and different, life does in fact manifest itself to her, and it's like you created this situation where, and it's a very interesting situation, isn't it?
the way the count a little bit drunken late night moment kind of puts it to himself. I mean, kind of in meditating it is that death with a capital D is famously kind of portrayed in a variety of literature and mythology as one who can kind of sneak into town or, you know, come through the back door and confront you or the next person and sort of appear by surprise and you know, there's nothing you can do about it when he's there. And the count sort of makes the observation that what is less often told is that life is the same way, that it too can, you know, sneak into town or come through the back door and present itself. And, you know, I do think there is, you know, truth to that. That's certainly what happens to various characters, but is that, you know, we often in our lives are kind of targeting some sense of equilibrium. You know, okay, we've got our place where we live, and, you know, it's fully furnished, and, you know, we've got a job, and we've got habits with our kids, and so everything's normal, you know. Now we can just keep, we can go on indefinitely with this pattern that we've got in place, and it's very hard to maintain, you know, that kind of pattern, as comfortable or as, you know, satisfying as it can be. Things intervene, you know, and both good and bad, you know, but there will be, you know, life will show up and kind of, you know, tip over the table a little bit. That is a theme of the book.
Yeah, it's like John Lennon, you know, life is what happens when you're busy making other plans.
Right, right.
And it's very true, and it's very true in this book. And you're constrained. Before you began this book, you created certain constraints on what you could do because you limited yourself, as we talked about earlier, spatially.
Yep.
And so you made the idea of travel other than in one's memory impossible, literally.
Yeah, and that is, I mean, constraints can be very productive to an artist. You know, and I'm not going to compare myself to Melville, but if you think about it, you know, Moby Dick is structured in a similar way in that Ishmael and we go on a boat, you know, the Pequod, in like whatever it is, chapter three, whatever, very quickly, and we don't get off. You know, I mean, so you're on a boat with a small, it's a very confined space, very small group of people, and you know, you go on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages, and that is a confinement or a constraint that Melville has accepted, which brings some energy to his narrative. You know, by virtue of that, he has to bring the world into the boat through all these inventive ways, and succeeds at doing so, in my opinion. But and that's part of the fun of it is seeing how the world gets drawn into that boat at sea.
You know, my very favorite line in the What is my favorite line in the entire
book? Oh, I have no idea. I would not be able to guess. I would be sad if I could guess, because it would probably mean there's only one good line in the book. But go ahead.
My favorite line is, just because I am such a sucker for it, is when the Count tells Sophia, "Were you to play on the moon, I would hear every chord."
Okay. You're a sentimentalist. You're a sentimentalist.
Yes, I cried. But I cry at McDonald's commercials, so don't.
Okay.
It's not that big.
I won't let it go to my head.
Yeah. Talk about the game Zut, how it came about.
The game Zut is a game that the Count plays with a younger woman who's kind of in his care, who grows to be a teenager, and it's basically, you at dinner, you choose a category that's very, it could be arcane, like winged animals that are not birds, you know, winged living things that are not birds, and you then go back and forth, and in essence, you know, the person who cannot play, maybe they've run out of ideas, loses the round. And we, the game is something that my wife and I and my children invented together for just that purpose. We placed our order. We are waiting for, you know, the first course. You're kind of, my kids were quite young. Is what can we do all together? What game can we play? You know, we're not going to talk about the, you know, the election. You know, when my kids are, you know, 6 and 9 or whatever it is, 7 and 10, and so we play this. And when it could be things like in the book, they play black and white animals, because almost any age you can play that. In fact, kids are pretty good at it, because, you know, they've studied animals more than we have. You know, we forget animals, and so. But as I say, the, you know, the winged, you know, creatures that other than birds, you know, we didn't do that. It's not in the book.
Nope.
But we've played that as a family, and it's surprising. You know, there's, you know, bats fly, squirrels fly, there's fish that fly. You know, there's all the entire insect community. You know, has, you know, a whole wide array with wings, dragonflies, butterflies, and bees. And so the game, just when you think that you know, there only be three plays and then the games would be over, no, we keep going. And you know, if you're willing to let, you know, mythical figures show up, you know, then you get Pegasus and dragons and, you know. So, but yeah, it's a game of that in a way, it plays a thematic role to some degree in the book, because it's sort of like the bigger project, right? It's like a game in a car. You know, when you're with your family in a station wagon driving to Ohio or whatever, you know, you're trapped and you play these games. You know, these like 20 questions to pass the time, and you know, they can be, you know, fond memories can come out of that, and Zut sort of plays that role for the two of them in the hotel.
Do you guys ever do it? Do you still do it now, every once in a while, like just like old times?
Yeah. Now we play cards more than that, because my children are, you know, closer to teenagers. So, but yeah.
Yeah, I always used to, when my kids were really little, and we'd go to the convenience store, and I'd always get whatever I'd get. I'd put my coffee on the hood, and I'd go inside the car, and I'd go, let's see. I feel like I've forgotten something.
Yeah. Right. Right.
They go, coffee. And but unfortunately, people would come by and go, "Hey, you left your coffee on your hood, man." So it screwed up the whole game every time. So here's what we'll do. Let's play a game of Zut. If you do really poorly, I'm going to delete it out of the show. And if I do really poorly, I'm going to delete it out of the show.
All right, well, what's the category?
Well, since I read your bio and you love 70s cop shows, and I do too.
Oof. Yeah, good.
All right. Who goes first, me or you?
I'll go first. Rockford Files.
Damn it. Well, The Rockford Files, he's not a cop, though. But okay, so we can do it that way, right?
I mean, it's because there's cops in the show, right? It's crime, and so...
Got it, all right.
The main character does not have to be a cop. It's
okay,
a
then
show,
then Beretta would work?
Absolutely.
Okay, Beretta.
Kojak.
Barnaby Jones.
Okay.
Well, okay.
Yeah, I guess we can do that. You go Quincy, right?
Quincy is my cousin. Jack Klugman was my cousin.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that.
All right, so are you saying Quincy?
I'll say Quincy, sure. If you're going to say Barnaby Jones, I'll say Quincy.
Then here's a true one, Hawaii Five-0.
Yeah, see, there's a grand one. Good for you. Angie Dickinson in Police Woman.
Oh, man. Adam 12.
Okay.
That's police. That's real police.
Yeah, Columbo.
He said Barnaby Jones, Columbo, Beretta. Not supposed to have quiet time on the radio. Damn it. That motorcycle one with Eric. California Highway. Chips.
Yeah, okay. McMillan and Wife.
Oh, that was with Rock Hudson and...
Yeah.
I forgot who the other one was.
Jill St. John?
Yeah, Jill St. John, who was really hot for a time, but then she didn't seem so hot anymore.
Yeah.
Starsky and Hutch.
Oh, that's a good one. McCloud.
That was...
Dennis Weaver,
yeah.
The cowboy in New York,
and he had in the beginning, it was him on the horse riding down the Fifth Avenue.
Yeah, exactly, right.
All right, one of my favorites was Mannix, although it was really bad.
Oh, that's a good one, yeah. Oh, then I'll do Ironside.
Cannon.
Oh, yeah. Cannon, good one.
Well, they're like the same, all three of them.
Yeah. I give up.
I don't want to be totally silent on the radio, so people are going to turn it off.
No, if they say uncle, I'm giving up.
Yeah, I know, but you're giving up. Okay, yeah. I can't think of any others either. Sure. We did Barnaby Jones. We did Rockford Files. Did we do Kojak?
I did. That was early on. Yeah.
All right. Okay, so I win, kind of.
Yeah, you win.
Okay, so I'll leave it in then. So, in conclusion, I think I have so many questions about so many other characters, but obviously I should leave this for the readers and who will definitely enjoy this book. And as I said, having an independent bookstore, it's lovely to have. Right now, seriously, on our bestseller shelf, both books are there, one in paperback, one in hardback. So it's a pleasure once again, Emma, to talk to you and to have the ability to talk to you about both of the novels that you've written. So thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
That was Amor Towles. He was talking to us today about his newest book. Just came out in a couple weeks ago. Gentleman in Moscow. It's his debut novel was Rules of Civility, which is great. Everybody's read it. Everybody loved that book. And this is just as good and much more romantic. Well, that book was really romantic too, but more romantic in the, fantastic sense. And I heartily recommend it. It's one of the best books I've read this year. But, join us every week because we always have good books. National Book Award finalist Patrick Phillips will be here with his latest book, Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America, which is kind of harrowing but well worth reading. Michael Honegg will discuss his fascinating novel, which is almost bookended, no pun intended again, with this one. It's called The Senility of Vladimir P., which deals with Vladimir Putin and some future in which he becomes senile and spends his time reminiscing over the days of thuggery, which may occur again here in our country. And then Jade Chang will be here to discuss her debut novel, which is hilarious, called The Wangs Versus the World, about the concept of the American dream, your entitlement to it, and what happens when you don't get it or it's taken away from you. So in any event, I think I've covered everything. Oh, we won the... here's what we won recently. We won Best Bookstore in Philadelphia from Philadelphia Magazine, which is the crown jewel. Then we won Best Bookstore on the Main Line. Then we won Best Bookstore on Philly.com. And we won Best Bookstore in the Daily Local. So we must be doing something right, or the people who work for me are doing something right. Certainly not me. Anyway, thanks as always, and we will talk to you next week here on The Avid Reader.